Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer. I'm here at the SiriusXM studios at the Wynn in Las Vegas. I think it's the greatest podcast studio ever built, at least in America, at least the ones that I've been in. And I'm blessed to have one of the greatest guests today. Our friend Amrinder Kamboge is here to be with us today. Welcome, Amrinder.
Thanks, Dave, for having me.
In your journey, it's much like mine. Coming from very little and creating a lot and learning the lessons of loss. And I was curious to start, how did you transition the meaning of your past to create greater exponential value into your future? So many people, even when they're successful, they can't get rid of the shadows of the past, and it foreshadows their future by limiting their own self-image, which then you can't ever overachieve your own self-image. So Amrinder, what was it that allowed you to change that meaning of your past to get you to where you are today?
I personally believe, Dave, there's a paradigm shift that everybody needs to go through. Okay. The reason why I'm saying that is what happens is, as we're getting older, there's multiple different things that I kind of want to touch bases. Okay. One, I'm very blessed with the parents that I have. Okay. The reason why I say that is I saw my dad struggle, you know? So he left India when he was 25 years old. Let me ask you this, Dave. 25 years old, where was Dave when he was 25?
Yeah, I actually was in a really good place by luck. But before 25, I was broke as anything with a single mom, six kids, just trying to buy her a house and pay off my law loans.
Yeah. But so same thing with my dad. He's overseas. Okay. He has parents. They're barely surviving in a way. Okay. Then he's like, you know what? I need to do something to go to the next phase of my life to provide for more for my family. Leaves India, leaves everything, goes to Germany, leaves that, starts all over, comes to America. Now, the biggest thing question I always...
How much in his pocket?
Nothing, honestly, nothing. And that's a key success ingredient that a lot of people don't understand is, so like for us, we're in the phase of life where we have the jets, we have the cars, we have all this, but people don't see the struggles that we've been through. Even with my dad too, although he's probably not at that bar that I'm at, right? But I'm never going to get to the level that where he's been through. Why? Because I didn't have to start from the ground up. I didn't have to leave my family, go to a country, not know the language. Think about it. You don't know the language, number two. You don't know where you're going to stay. Number three, you have zero in your pocket. At 25 years old, you're lost. You see what I'm trying to say?
Oh, I know.
So that struggle is compared to my struggle, right? So growing up, I always saw my dad struggle. And then from there, it went to be like, okay, he's doing that, but he's moving, he's grooving. Right? Role model. Then when 21 years old, I have the GNC and everything. A lot of things were happening. You know, me and my partner, we split and everything. I used to beat myself for it, very high anger and stuff. And then I don't know what happened to me inside. I started realizing, okay, there's many different things that are going to happen in my life. I'm only 23, 24, 25 years old around that time, 24 years old. I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, a lot of stuff is going to happen in my life. Rather than me thinking to the point and beating myself of what's happened in the past, what are some of the things that we need to learn? Right? Yeah. Think about it. Life is what? It's a student of subject. You have to be the subject of life, right? And the biggest lesson you're always going to learn from what? From struggle.
Yeah, there's light, love, and lessons in every struggle. Now, one of the things that I've learned in the context of the struggle or the problems that exist is every problem has its solution already in it. It's just a lapse of time for us to learn the lessons. And those who learn the lessons not only quicker, but learn the lessons the first time, are suited to have the exponentiality of success that they've had. One of the more impressive things that I didn't know, you know, I always say when I'm speaking on stages, you know, who here grew up with nothing? Half of the audience puts their hand up and I say, oh, I feel sorry for the rest of you. I was with Eddie Wilson, the founder of Aspire. I'm on the Aspire tour. Eddie grew up in a family office, like extreme generational wealth already. And he grew up with generational wealth. What's so impressive is I see how people like me make it because they have nothing to lose, no expectation other than they're going to lose.
Correct.
And we have this basement that we can bounce off of where people like Eddie, people who have generational wealth, people who have wealth in general, usually don't have the same drive. And they don't have the same consistent behaviors. For you, how important was that first struggle with your retail GNC that you had a failure kind of right off the bat compared to if you were successful from the start, would you think your perspective would have been, hey, everything's going to be easy for me moving forward from here?
No. So yeah, good question. So I'm actually, I think I'm very blessed that they happen at a very young age. There's two things that happen as we're getting older. So first 30 years of your life, you're doing what? You're learning. Second 30, you're building. The next 30, you're just relaxing and enjoying the fruits of labor. Right.
So I'm almost there, bro. I'm 57. So
you're there.
You got three more years.
So what happens is, Dave, like, let me ask you this. When it gets to the point where you're like 60-ish, whatever, right? You start putting a little bit on the brakes.
I actually have, because I'm very time oriented, for the last 3 years and going into the next 3 years, I've told everyone in my organization that my plan is exactly that. When I'm, because my youngest son, I have four kids, is going to college when I'm 60. And I know I want to change my priorities, my non-negotiable behaviors, not with sleep, not with health, not with family. But for example, you asked me how many interviews I've already done today. That's going to change.
Yeah.
There'll be no need to do as much in the interview side that I do. I'd rather spend that time, as you said, put a little bit of the brakes on.
Yeah, yeah. You probably still do them and like the interviews, but there will be different qualified interviews.
Right.
Right? Like the level of spectrum of the people that you're going to have the conversation, that's what changes. Right? So it's like one of those things, like what I like to tell people is like, okay, for an example, I started when I was 21, right? The odds on my bet to failing was very high.
97%.
Think about it. 21 years old. Like what are you supposed to be doing? You're supposed to be out drinking, partying, chasing girls. Right? But I'm out there working more into clothes. And then I had another thing. I have a GNC. Do I want to start on my own? Or do I just take over my dad's business and just kind of piggyback off of that?
Yeah.
Right? So, but there's two things. But I chose the other route. Why? Because growing up, I was embedded in my mind, no matter what happened, my dad did what he did. Okay? But that's dad's money. A lot of people don't think, especially in our Indian community, they don't think like that. They want to piggyback off their dads.
Yeah.
Right? But I wanted to be, dude, he did his thing, but I want to create my own legacy. A lot of people don't talk about legacy. The biggest thing I teach my guys in my organization is if you were to die when you're like 65 years old and you're above there, what do you want to be known for? What kind of quality of people are at your funeral is going to tell you exactly the amount of impact we've made. It gets to the point where you make enough money in life, right? That the money doesn't even matter.
Of course.
It's all about purpose driven. And a lot of companies, that's every single company that's been successful has always been purpose driven.
And when you have your own venture company, most people don't even know this about me. I got hired into the sports world to run the most notable sports agency, not because I was a great lawyer, not because I was a great sports agent. It was because I had the highest level of anyone that was capable of running the sports agency in venture and technology. That's where my background actually was, beyond the law degree, beyond the sports background. I really was a venture capitalist and a technology guy since 1992. Mm-hmm. And Lee Steinberg said, the future of sports is in venture and technology. I believe the future of everything, whether you're an electrician today, you know, I was meeting with a guy who has a window washing company, does really well. But it's all really about the PE firms and the roll-ups, yeah, and the technology that they can implement in order to create greater margins, because most window washing companies have no technology. You're sitting in the hotbed of venture and technology. Gives you great flexibility, adaptability to use the skills, knowledge, and desires that you have. It's not easy, though. People think that venture is easy once you have money. It's actually extremely difficult.
It is.
What lessons have you learned as you went on your own to be a venture company and to be able to pick and choose the right people who will make the right winners?
So one of the biggest thing is when you're acquiring companies, right? So a lot of people ask me this. You just the other day in Dallas, we were talking about acquiring another company for this other health business we're trying to acquire. But then before we acquire that, how are we going to make that into where it's scalability? Scalability is the number one thing I always look at when I acquire businesses. Venture capital, that's the biggest thing. They don't look at that. You got to look at a 5 to 10 year term rate. Number two is I started thinking of how can we take this and make it into a platform? You and I understand what a platform is. Mm-hmm. And you hit it on the dot. Technology is the only way to make it into a platform. Because when you're trying to flip a company, right? One is systems is what they're looking at. If I need to replace a CEO or a vice president of the company or CMO or COO, how fast can I replace that person? right? Then number two is the technology part of it. Why? Because when you want to go IPO, the valuation is going to increase 10 times higher because of the technology. Especially nowadays with AI, everybody has a chance. Like the person that you're talking about, the window cleaning guy, there's a lot of technology that they can add simple stuff to increase the valuation, but nobody thinks like that. Another thing is too, when we think about businesses, let's just talk about small business owners. Okay. The new game of mergers and acquisitions, it's increasing very high. A lot of people are talking about mergers, acquisitions, right? Even if you're a small person, even if you're a small company doing about 5 million and a blow, you still need to think about what is my exit plan. Nobody thinks that way.
It's so true. And part of the variance of AI especially is that, you know, it took 30 years for the Industrial Revolution to take place. It takes sometimes 30 weeks for the same type of advancement and growth determined upon the industry careers or jobs that you're looking at. And it creates a great risk for venture because, like you said, anybody can all of a sudden become competitive in the right industry, career, or job. There's this interesting balance between the people and the technology.
Right.
And I used to be able to just invest in the person, knowing that that person has a desire that they must be what they can be. They have great skills and knowledge in the space. I was almost guaranteed some sort of return on my investment when I bet on the great jockeys. But I can have a great jockey, and within literally 30 weeks to a year, the entire business has changed to make even, you know, the greatest leader a failure very quickly in my investment in the timing and risk tolerance involved. How have you dealt with the other side of technology where you can't always get a great grip on the competition, one, or two, where the market's going?
So one of the things is like, you hit it on the dot. When you're acquiring companies, that's my biggest philosophy as well too. You always bet on the CEO. Okay. And then the other thing is too, is like when you're talking to the CEO, my biggest question is where their vision is going for the next 5 to 10 years. And if they're not adding platforms like technology into it, and they're not adding other AI related things or anything like that, that's not your CEO. Number two is, and CEO's biggest job is what? To build other leaders.
Culture.
Correct. Majority of businesses, they fail because they don't have culture and they don't have a CEO that can be a leader. You can fix all the kinks and everything else in the business, no problem. You can hire people, an HR department, all that kind of stuff. But as a CEO, if everybody else cannot look up to the CEO and the CEO can't duplicate himself and create other leaders, your business is gone. You know, and then from there, like you said, when it comes to any business, the technology piece of it is just, it's more about speed. And a good CEO understands speed. That's it. Right. So I've had conference. We were looking at buying a company, and I asked him, I was like, okay, where do you see the company going in the next 5 years? We see the company right now is doing 25 million XYZ, blah, 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 EBITDA, yada, 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 yada. The next 5 years, we're going to be doing about $150 million, blah, 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 yada, blah, 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 blah. Right. Okay. Great. Sorry. I can't. Right. He's like, why? What happened? Our company's so phenomenal. You're going to make a lot of money. Yeah. But you didn't even talk about any of the cultures or anything like that. Mm. Our company is this purpose driven. This is what we're trying to do. We're out trying to add technologies for XYZ, yada, 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 yada. You and I know this too, is any CEO that just talks about revenue, EBITDA, and profitability, there's no purpose behind it. What is he going to do? You're going to partner up with him. He's going to look for the next chase.
Yep.
And I've made those bets before, and I've lost a lot of money on that stuff.
I'm with you. And, you know, I have a systematic way in the venture that I utilize, and it's based off of Napoleon Hill, which I'm blessed to be the chairman of Napoleon Hill Institute, which is based upon a definiteness of purpose and also the understanding of how intention works and intentionality works. Values, daily practices, and an execution model. Yep. Which is the platforms, right, as you stated. And if when I'm asking someone, where do you see yourself? I call it a divine direction. So I'm a little bit freakish or spiritual when I come to like putting a linear time frame on anything. So I'll say, tell me about your divine direction. You know, where you think you want to be or better a year, 3 years, or 5 years from now. Give me that outline. And if they don't talk about their values, culture, if they don't talk about the daily practices, meaning what systems do you have in place today in case you have a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
Or you're not the guy I think you are.
Yeah.
And then finally, the execution model, because just because the execution model isn't one I agree with, that doesn't bother me at all. It just lets me know what I'm going to need to change. And it might actually be the reason why I invest, because if they're doing those kind of numbers but have a poor execution model,
you know,
then I know I got huge margins to come with the guys and the values, et cetera, in place. Do you have non-negotiable values 100%. That you look for? What are they?
100%. So we actually just recently created a book. It's called Amarindo's Success Playbook.
You say your first name so easily. That's amazing.
Well, man, I'm 32 years. I've been saying it for 32 years of my life. So this book was designed. I got interviewed by one of my good friends, Dan. And so have you ever seen the show Billions?
Of course.
Okay. So Axe, he has his lady. She's like a psychiatrist.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So in our company too, when you're dealing with all this number stress and like multiple companies, all these countries and all that kind of stuff, in our organization, we have him to reflect on all my guys. Any problem, whatever you got, you talk to this guy.
Corporate therapist.
It's a corporate therapist. And so even with me, when we're dealing with all these numbers, they come, my guys, they come with me with solutions, not problems, which is a good thing to have.
Yeah.
Right. So that's my number one non-negotiable. When we're partnering up, there's a section in there that says, the first thing you do is, if you and I, me and Dave, right? And this is very important. Nobody really talks about this. And I made this mistake in my previous careers, right? Is before you do any type of document sign, you got both got to put everything on the table and both got to agree on terms. So I have my full 10 list. If you don't have one, come back and let's sit down. Let's talk about it. And we have to agree. And we sign that thing. It's like a declaration to me. Because then everything's on the paper. Dave understands what I stand for. And I understand Dave. It's like a marriage, right?
Yeah.
And then it's like the first thing on my thing is, look, if anything happens in the business, there's things where your organization or my organization, they need to know. Let's just say 80% of the things. But there's a lot of close behind the scenes conversation that me and Dave would have. Okay. That cannot be on the phone. No text message or nothing. It has to be in person. And if there's a third partner, it definitely has to be in a third person. Sorry, like in person for sure. Because a lot of conflict happens is, let's just say there's a guy named Nick right here. All through us three, we create a company, right? Dave calls Nick. Nick says something else. He probably didn't understand something or texts him. And then Nick calls me. Boom. Now what happens? Friction.
Yeah.
And that happens all the time. My second thing is there's no such thing as a 50-50% partnership. Never. Somebody's always doing something more than the other guy. So I'm willing to take less percentage if I'm not able to bring enough onto the table. And I've seen a lot of friendship, family members, good partners go into big lawsuit battles because of that, because they think it's 50-50, but somebody else doing more. Then what happens? A lady gets involved, the wife, spouse, whoever it is, says, dude, you're doing more than this guy. Yeah, XYZ. That's the other thing too, is like, it's between me and Dave.
Yeah.
Not between the wives. I don't want your opinion. You don't know what happened at work. That's another thing too. So when you go home, you talk about the business, but you don't talk about what happened between you and your partner.
Right.
Because they don't know what happened. Does that make sense?
So much it makes sense. And being and having partnerships over the years with also some very notable people, getting other people involved in what I call memorializations. Most memorializations that you have need to be open-ended in the respect that you have to understand time, value, and emotion. Correct. Changes.
Yep.
So I keep flexibility and adaptability in all my agreements that says, look, you have permission to change. Change your mind, change the agreement. And also to say no.
Yeah.
And if those three things or one of those three things should happen, then we're going to deal with it this way. But it's all up front. And I never could have been able to do that if I wasn't now 57 years old. And I'm in that second, the last part of my second phase, as you suggest.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of dummy tax that I paid along the way. All relative to my last question. My favorite quote is, and it's still applicable today, you're either humble or you're about to be. And I've been very, very financially successful twice in my life. And the first one time around, I wasn't humble. And even though I've had the greater success now in my life, and I practice humility as much as possible, there's still times that I have to remind myself, you're either humble or you're about to be.
Yeah.
For you, is that a challenge, number one? And if so, when is it the greatest challenge to be humble?
It's not really a challenge for me. The reason why is, okay, so I drive a black, nice, beautiful Cullinan, okay? Before that, I had a nice pickup truck. That's what kept me happy. Then about the Cullinan. Now we got the jet. Now we're buying another jet. And then we're doing all that kind of stuff. But I'm okay to sit on a commercial flight as well to just remind me that that's where I was at.
Yep.
I'm okay driving, and I purposely do this. Drive a Toyota Sequoia that my dad has since 2005, and I used to drive that thing all the time going to work and everything. You know, and the reason why I do that is, one, it reminds me if you can go like this, you can go like this, right? Number two, it reminds me too is when I used to have that car, I remember listening to a shit ton of podcasts and I was learning. So purposely I do that, right? Number three is like, it's just at the end of the day, it's what throws you humble. When you start becoming unhumble is the people that are surrounding you, when they start hyping you up.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Wrong voices, wrong
the wrong voices. Yeah. So my organization, the people that I hang on with, they're already there. But then what happens is when I get to the point where it's your dinner table is going to decide basically who you're going to be. Right.
I love that. Yeah.
Right. So on the dinner table, if I'm the one that's the richest guy, right, you got to change the dinner table. And that, I feel like that's where the humbleness lacks, you know? And then rather than you talking about, so with me and my organization, I don't even talk about myself. Like, I've done so many podcasts. I'm lifting up my guys because I know for a fact I'm one guy, but I have 2,000 other people around the world that are working for me. If I don't have them, I ain't going to be where I'm at.
No doubt.
Then what happens is, number two is you lift them up. And then what you got is you got to make sure their goals, their personal, professional, financial goals are met as well too. You know? So being humble, I don't think is a thing. It's the way you do things and the people you surround with is going to determine how humble you're going to be, or you're going to be humbled. Because there's been a lot of people like I'm 32. I will sit down with a 75-year-old dude, and they're talking about all this stuff and all kind of stuff. And I'll check them. I'll check them on the spot, and that's where and that's how they become humble.
Exactly. The only way to get to where you want to be is know your who. Who sits in a situation that you want to be in and ask them for help, but also who can you help get to where they want to be or better. And that's what they're doing at Kim Job Ventures. Amrinder, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Dave.
It's an amazing interview, amazing lessons. We're learning here at the SiriusXM Studios at the Wynn in Las Vegas. I'm David Meltzer. This is Entrepreneurs, the Playbook.